Welcome to the Digital Forensics Now podcast. Today is Thursday, May 16th, 2024. My name is Alexis Brignoni, aka Briggs, and I'm accompanied by my co-host, the one that puts the tech in techno, the patience generator, the gluten-free pita that's healthy for you, the one and only Heather Charpentier. The music is Higher Up by Shane Ivers and can be found at SilvermanSound.com.
The gluten-free pita.
Yeah, you know, you're healthy, you know, all that working out that we're doing.
All of a sudden. Oh, my gosh.
I like the patience generator more, and you know why I say that.
I do. I definitely do.
Hello, everybody. I'm happy that, well, we're happy that you're all here. People are starting to roll in to the chat and whatnot. What's going on, Heather? Since IASIS, what you been up to?
Nothing. We're back from IASIS. 2024 is over for IASIS. Now we got to start working on 2025. Let's take a couple weeks off first.
Yeah. Let's take almost 1 year off.
Okay. All right. We'll start thinking about it though. But being away for 2 weeks, came right back to a trial that had already started and had a message on my phone. Hey, I'm going to need you to testify. So that's what I did this week. Testified in a trial. Fun times.
I always freak out before I go testify, but then when I'm there, I'm like into it.
Yeah. So I was freaking out for this. I haven't testified in a little while. It's been a little bit. And I was freaking out for this one like I was for the very first time I ever testified. I'm like, what is going on? And you're right. As soon as I got in that seat, I was absolutely fine. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the good thing about, you know, the type of work that we do, because we're there for the facts. So there's nothing I need to be afraid of. It is what it is. And that's what's going to happen. It's what's going to come out.
Still, that panic factor happens every time.
Oh, yeah. And I take that as a symbol that we take it seriously. And that's a good thing.
It's definitely the unknown of what's going to be asked by the other side. So,
and sometimes by your side, too.
That's true. Oh, that's really true. Especially when it's last minute, right?
I don't know where you're going with these questions, but here we go.
Don't ask that. Please don't ask that.
There's some conference coming up, right?
Yeah. I'm going to Techno in a couple of weeks. So, I've been asking to go to the Techno conference for like 9 years since I started working at the State Police Forensic Lab. And at the time, we weren't allowed to go because it was in Myrtle Beach, and Myrtle Beach is too fun, apparently. So now that it's in Wilmington, North Carolina, I get to go this year for the first time. So super excited. Looking forward to that.
No fun allowed.
I know. I'm surprised I was allowed to go to Orlando for IASIS, but actually we weren't allowed to for years. So.
No, that's actually not only your agency. Yeah. Even you know, federal agencies at some level, they put some constraints because, you know, we don't want to give the impression that we're there for the party, which again, we're not. We're there to learn, obviously.
Right. I have a feeling Vegas would be a problem.
Well, I just want to say that I'm not jealous or envious at all that you're going to Techno.
I wish you were going.
Me too. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, again, it's hard to... Now you said just get the approvals and the funding. It's not always easy, but well, there's a will, there's a way. We'll find a way.
What's been going on with you?
So talking about places and to be and things to do, I'll be teaching next week at the Department of the Interior campus over at West Virginia. So I'm really excited about that. And then after that, I'm going to Argentina. So don't cry for me.
Argentina. No, I'm jealous. I kind of want to go on that trip.
Going to beautiful Buenos Aires, one of the most beautiful cities, one of my favorite cities in the whole world.
I'll need an assistant. No? All right.
And look, I mean, if I could, I would. But yeah, I'll be teaching there, you know, and working with some of the local agencies from the region. And then I'm going to be the second week, I'll be working with the FASTA Engineering University, again, some community programs and talking about Python, the Leap, CTAR Forensics, and also working with the local prosecutors there. I will be remiss if I don't mention that Kevin, the man with the master plan, the man with the repo powers, The one that approves and can also cancel you is in the chat. So, Kevin, glad to have you here.
Hi, Kevin.
And for folks that don't know, Kevin, he's one of the the main repository maintainer for the LEAP programs, and he's been keeping the fort up and handling all things. So, again, I couldn't thank you enough for the work that you do, Kevin. So, thank you. So, yeah, so that's what's happening. I'll tell the folks that are listening and watching, we might skip a show because, again, we'll be traveling. Heather will be in Techno. I'll be overseas. So we might have to skip a show here and there. But just keep your eyes on our LinkedIn page, Digital Forensics Now Podcast, and then we'll make announcements if we're missing a show or when we'll miss it and when we're going to make the show live again. So, all right. Any other news that we're missing, like short stuff? We're good?
I think that's good, except for I just wanted you to know that you're making Kevin blush.
well, good, because he deserves all the blushes. He's awesome. All right, we got a lot of stuff. Yeah. So tell us what's on.
So the first topic I wanted to talk about is iOS Unified Logs. So we've talked a few times about Lionel Notari's work with the Unified Logs. He's doing a ton of testing and also has a tool that has the capability of pulling the Unified Logs. I demoed it on a previous episode of the podcast. So for his new blog, he's actually outlining driving and motion states. It's really some cool research. I'm going to pop up some slides that go along with it. So he's conducting research, and he outlines in his blog that it could be really useful research when it comes to distracted driver cases. And after reading all of his research, it really will be useful in distracted driver cases. I've worked a few of them, and knowing that these logs are here and being able to utilize them and match them up with other artifacts inside of the device, it can really help bolster the case. So he has artifacts such as the driving motion states. So the first motion states are stationary to walking. You can see them here in the slides, but stationary to walking and then stationary to running. And it's capturing these transitions between the motion states. And when it comes to the vehicles, there are vehicle start times and vehicle stop times and transitions from stationary into vehicle motion states. So here's just an outline of the start time and what that entry would look like in the unified logs.
Yeah, and can you go one slide back? I always make a quick comment. So for the folks that are just listening, you can't see what we're showing on the screen. You got to remember a couple of things. This unified logs, it requires you to do certain things either to the phone or have some software to pull those out. They just don't sit there for you to get. So if you're just taking an extraction from the phone, you're not going to see them, right? You need to do these extra steps. And we discussed this maybe a few episodes back. So I don't remember specifically which one.
Yeah.
But we talk about software to include, some software that Lionel also does to pull this out. And what you see on the screen, folks, is a timestamp for that event and then the particular service or system within the device, be it location D or the Wi-Fi service or the whatever service it is, telling you something about what's happening on the phone. And like Heather is saying, like the vehicular state or start time and what happens, right? And or the motion, is it state driving? Is it stationary? So it's really impressive, this amount of data. And you need to be aware that when you're done with your extraction, be it file, full file system or whatever it is, start looking into these iOS unified logs for this type of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. There's the same type of data when it comes to driving stopped. So the transition will be the motion state will transition to driving stopped. And then he also did some research on the out of my pocket. He called it get the phone out of my pocket. So there's different states that show if the phone is out of the pocket, if it's in your pocket, if it's face down, or if it's face down on a table. I want to also just point out that he mentions numerous times in his research, and I'm glad, really, really glad he does this, that there needs to be secondary sources to validate this this data. He's found that some of them can be imprecise and some were pretty precise, but throughout the article, he continues to just let the user or the reader know that there needs to be verification, validation for the accuracy of the data stored in these logs.
Yeah, and that's key because these are sensors, and that's the part that people really don't think about. You have what's recorded, but that recording in your device, be it a car, a phone, whatever it is, it's a reading from a sensor. Now, how is this sensor calibrated? Well, that's an extra step that we don't think about, right? Right. And maybe it's calibrated in a way that a certain move of the phone will be registered as something that might not be it. So that's why you got to be really careful and look, from my perspective, and you can tell me if you think I'm wrong or not, don't look at the one thing, right? You got to look at a series of events across a particular a time frame to then be able to determine, the movement was this, or no, there was no movement. Because if you focus only on this event at minute number one, second three, you could be wrong, really, really wrong. You need to look at a few of them across a large enough time frame to be able to make proper conclusions.
Right. And when he was doing the research, he actually outlines that the pocket states are what he found to be very imprecise. So minor movements were making some of those changes, but also that comes along with do your own testing on it as well. Mm-hmm. Find out what is precise, what is imprecise, what things you can use. And I think kind of going along with what you just said, these could fit really nice into a timeline with other artifacts where they match right up and they're showing the progression of what's going on with the device.
Oh, yeah. And I think digital forensics is moving into that. We like the whole ones and zeros, yes or no. But we got to start thinking of data as a continuum of a degree of this sensor recordings, right? And those recordings are a reflection of events that happen in the real world. And they need to be taken with that. We talk about this in other episodes, taken with that degree of uncertainty, because there is some uncertainty there. And we need to consider that as we make our analysis.
Yeah. I see the comments. You had no idea that the logs had all that stuff. I didn't either. When I read this, I was like, you have to be kidding me. I've never seen this before.
Oh yeah. I mean, so you look at logs, right? And it's so much of it. And you're like, well, there's tons of stuff here. I don't see nothing, right? But what Lionel is doing, he's taking the time to really dig into them and say, oh, there's a nugget here. There's a nugget there. And folks like him bring so much to the community because now it makes our work easier because he's done the hard finding part, right? So Lionel, we appreciate your work. We appreciate you. And we're looking forward to all your new blog posts on the different things that you find. And my plan is hopefully down the road be able to support some of these in our tooling. So
yeah, I'm definitely stalking his LinkedIn page for all of the new blog posts. Kevin says there's an orientation and screen wake artifact in there that could be correlated with these two, so definitely pair it up with those other artifacts.
Yeah, I'm gonna share a comment here from Christian Peter. He's working on a master thesis for that, and that's fantastic because research at that level, master level thesis that goes through a peer review process and all that. Christian, whenever you get your stuff out and you're able to publish it, let us know and we'll share it with the community. We're really looking forward to that as well.
Yeah, definitely. Let me remove this here. Hold on one second. There we go. So,
yeah, we have some movement in the digital forensic space, and it's been a pretty heavy year so far, and we're about to hit the midpoint. So Tom Abravo announces a cash offer to acquire cybersecurity leader Darktrace, and this is how they obviously advertise that acquisition. So let me put folks on, give you a quick set the table on what's going on. So Tom Abravo is this investment I don't want to say investment firm, so how can work and word it? Like, let's call it investment firm for our purposes here. So they acquire businesses and they build them up, and obviously, to enhance stockholder share value, right? So they acquire Magnet Forensics. There's a lot of synergy, obviously, with Grey Keys, something that was happening way before Thoma Bravo showed up, right? Mm-hmm. That Magnet Grey Key synergy was there. They added with that Griffi. Mm-hmm. they added, I forgot the name of the company, but a company that deals with DVRs and extracting video from devices, which again, another field with a lot of growth there. And what I'm seeing is, they added also some analysis on video analysis as well, not only extraction, but video analysis, support for that, acquiring companies. They even recently acquired an exploit firm. And what that means is that they're looking for really smart folks that are able to provide us access to devices to be able to lawfully obtain evidence, okay? So what I'm seeing is they're actually becoming, kind of building this big behemoth in regards to their forensic offering. And this latest one with Darktrace is really interesting because it goes beyond the purely forensic side of the business, right? So what Darktrace does is they have some AI solutions for incident response and incident response prevention. And what that does, and I think it's one of the few, from my perspective, one of the few clear AI reasons to exist that actually makes sense to me, all right? And I say that because what the AI does, based on my understanding of their business, is that the AI can baseline the network, can baseline your endpoints in your enterprise. And after that is baseline is set, the AI is able to determine any deviations from this baseline, which could mean, you know, either an attack is ongoing or some evilness is spreading to the network. And that knowledge eventually then leads to other AI responses in regards to containment, in regards to alerting the folks that need to know about it, and in regards to also prevention, right? Prevention, containment, and resolution. So having them acquire that and putting it together with all the other Magna Forensics, Gray Key tooling capabilities, I think it's going to really, they're turning into a really big player at a speed that I don't think, from my perspective, other companies in the space are doing right now.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I read an article that went along with this particular topic, and they were saying that their goal is to automate all of these functions and streamline it and really work on that backlog of case data that everybody has, right? So I don't know. I don't know how I feel about the automation, though.
Yeah, and they have a solution that actually we'll talk about it in a second. I'll make one quick point, and then we'll go into that sure. Automation piece. This is a hard analysis trying to predict what could happen because I see the value in having all these tools and expanding into the incident response field. Yeah. And obviously, I'm pretty sure they're going to expand also even more. They do already, but even more into the e-discovery area. And it comes with the benefit of, hey, you have all these baskets now that you can put eggs in. But also is the question is, will they lose focus on their main core capabilities? And that's always that I've seen happen in this industry when a company that's focused on digital forensics expands to other markets, they lose that focus on their primary mission. And then they have to eventually come back to it. So is that what's going to happen? I don't know. I do know the few, you know, I know mostly folks from Magnet. And I know they're really capable folks. I don't know anything about the other companies. So it'll be interesting to see. And also interesting to see how other players in the market react. Are other companies that are primary digital forensics, are going to go in a buying spree again? Are they going to try to develop in-house solutions to compete with what Thoma Bravo is building in their portfolio? I don't know. I mean, I'm all for competition. So I'm happy that's happening.
I just hope they don't lose that customer service that we get from the tools that we mentioned that they're picking up.
Yeah, right. Again, maybe I'm overgeneralizing, but they become really big and then, customer support sucks or they outsource it to some company that that's not really their thing.
Right.
And it's bad.
Yeah, I don't want to start getting the answer, turn it off and turn it back on again.
did you try that? Yes.
Yeah. For the fifth time. Definitely. Definitely.
No, but to your point of automation, right? So actually, let me show folks quickly here. What Magnet Forensics, you know, as I guess from the public's perspective, kind of the big umbrella under which capabilities seem to be living. They came out with the concept of the Magnet One. And what Magnet wants is, and let me share here, what am I sharing here? Slide. Oh, sorry. Sorry, folks. I'm looking for, I forgot how to share stuff on my screen now. All right, here we go. Magnet One. Boom. All right. So what you see on the screen is you got on the left different evidence sources of evidence. You got a phone, a computer, cloud, legal returns, cars, drones, video, Wi-Fi, or a house with Wi-Fi signals coming out of it. I guess maybe that means like IoT stuff, I would assume. And then Magnet is saying, okay, we're going to, you know, handle your storage of the evidence in the cloud, which we have thoughts about that. A lot of thoughts. we're going to, you know, connect all these products, automate that case management, let you know when things are happening, have folks be able to collaborate all in one case remotely. And obviously the machine learning, which is, you know, another kind of older way of saying AI, right? Mm-hmm. And they're going to do that acquisition. That's how they advertise it. Do that workflow optimization, automate it, do some kind of an automated analysis, and then share it, right? And then the idea of them is, you know, eliminate backlogs faster to what you get, and we get it. And honestly, let's be real here. All companies in the space are proclaiming that their automation solutions do this, like literally. Mm-hmm. The question is for us is, okay, well, who's doing it better at the price point that actually makes sense? And it's going to be, again, I like competition. I'm hoping that this continues because, you know, at some point, hopefully economies of scale prevail and prices come back to a reasonable amount, because from my perspective, prices are getting really out of hand lately.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the bills definitely keep going up. So with the automation, though, good thing or bad thing?
Automation is good, but it could be such a crutch, right? Automation on pulling stuff, the data out of things, sure. I mean, that's pretty much
agree.
You know, yeah, right? Like a brain dead process. You
yeah,
know?
Please. Yeah, bring it all up front for me. Yes, I like that.
I'm okay with that. But when you automate the analysis, maybe I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, so forgive me, Heather, but...
That's okay.
you know, the tool might decide to show you something or not show you something, right? Based on many factors. But we usually don't get to know those factors. And actually, I'm not going to say it. We're going to talk about it a little bit later. So what do we do, right? And most folks, I'll be straight here, most folks just hit the button and whatever the tool spit out, that's it. They don't have the incentive. And I believe as a field, and Heather, I know you agree with me, we've been really hammering this drum and we'll continue to hammer it till the drum breaks.
Yes. Yes.
That we need to take ownership of our analysis. And that just gets whatever the tool spits out, you know?
So Caesar puts in a comment that is so 100% true, 1000% true. Management wants automation. They want automation. They want everything done as quick as possible, but they don't understand that the quicker we go and the more automation there is, the more of a chance that something is wrong or the less of a chance that something is verified or validated. So I love that comment. Well,
and
true.
About it. And again, we're talking about management in general terms. So the folks that we work for, we're not talking about you, okay? at all, all right? Mm-mm. So that being said.
They know.
exactly, of course they do. So that being said, this is the thing, right? They want automation, they want the results, they want the outcomes. But what happens if something goes wrong, right?
Right.
Management immediately wants accountability, right?
Yeah.
So where's the accountability going to lie? Well, the tool messed up. They're not going to take that for an answer.
Oh, no. Definitely not.
Yeah. And accountability is important. I mean, don't get me wrong. And it's something that Brett Shavers also bangs the drum a lot. The tool doesn't do the analysis. You, the examiner, you're the one that does the analysis. And the accountability is going to fall on you. Just because the tool did it or because you didn't know, it's not an excuse, right? Like the law, just because you have an absence of knowledge of the law doesn't excuse you or absolve you from breaking it, right? And accountability works the same way. I didn't know. I didn't mean it. Well, yeah, but you're still responsible. and people need to understand. We need to understand that. I need to understand that on a daily basis. Remind myself of it.
Mm-hmm. The automation, though, for that quick upfront look at what you need, I love it. I mean, it's great to have things right there parsed in your face when you first open up an extraction. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a place for it, but it worries me that we'll put too much emphasis on the automation and not enough on the actual forensics.
No, I agree with you. And again, you know, we're using the whole magnet automation plant as a as a segue to talking to a topic. Obviously, we're not referring to magnets specifically.
Right.
This is a general term for all the industry, right? And again, and we'll see this. I think this is a theme lately, Heather. I think it is. They give you a knife, and you can butter bread, or you can stab somebody with it. So,
<Yeah. laughs>
or stab yourself in this case. If you depend too much on the tool, and you're not careful, you're gonna stab yourself with it, and they'll be like, "Oh, what happened?" And that's a theme lately, and actually, it's gonna come up again with some of the different new tooling that's coming up. Automation is great, and AI is gonna continue to infiltrate the space, but it will not substitute the need for trained examiners, because the automation, the AI, has no accountability on its own.
Right.
The only people that are accountable are people.
I agree. Definitely. So you have a little thing to show here for Belka GPT, correct?
Yeah. And this definitely goes with the topic we just discussed, right, in regards to that accountability and tooling. And I want to show you how BelkaSoft, and it's actually, it was a pretty impressive, you know, presentation. So to give you guys some background, BelkaSoft had an event called Belka Day. So 2 days of conferences. I was honored to be invited to participate. And I talked about SecBees and some considerations in regards to pattern of life analysis in iOS and macOS devices. But before my talk, Jury, which is, you know, the president, founder, CEO, and owner of the company, BelkaSoft's a great product. He talked about some enhancement they're adding to the latest BelkaSoft Evidence Center X software suite. And they call it Belka GPT, right? I don't know if there's any relationship with GPT proper. I have no idea. But that's how they called it. Although we've seen, you know, other companies in the space also use words like Copilot, which, you know, kind of is used by multiple companies in the space.
Right.
If that makes sense. All right. So what I'm showing here on the screen, folks, is you see the dashboard, and you can go to data sources and you can enable the Belka GPT capability. So the big thing that Jury was kind of explaining was that this functionality or this large language model that they use, it's all offline. Well, let me rephrase that. It's all within your device, right? You don't have to connect to an external service to be able to have this AI work with you, your case. And of course, there's, from a technical standpoint, there's some benefits and drawbacks, right? There's some benefits in regards to data is kept locally. There's some drawbacks in regards to the capability for you to do some AI analysis will be limited by the hardware and software that you have. But the way he explained it is that the AI will work on computers without any GPU cards, only running on CPU power. Of course, if there's a GPU available, it will use it to expedite the process, but you don't need to have a supercomputer to run this. At least that's how Jury explained it, right? So after you enable the software, for example, he went and opened a chat from WhatsApp, and he saw some content there showing the audience, well, there's some conversation about Bitcoins, right? So we know it's there, for the sake of the demonstration. And then he goes to the BelkaSoft GPT interface there and says, any mention of cryptocurrencies? And, you know, a few seconds later, the software responds in natural language. Yes, there are mentions of cryptocurrencies in the text data, for instance, and explains a little bit of a summary of what the chat is, and then provides first message and the information, and then you can right-click on it and actually navigates you to that chat where the AI is making that reference, okay? And there is the Bitcoin message. Another example he gave is, does the case contain images of both faces and guns? And that's an interesting example because it's not one or the other, it's both. And the AI responds, yes, the case contains images with both faces and guns, and then shows the links, I say links, but shows the name, file names of those, and then you can click on them and go to them. And he did that, and then you show here a picture of a man holding what seems to be like some sort of rifle or shotgun. And it highlights the face, and there it is, right? And folks that are watching, they can see that. And, this is a quick side note here. It's interesting because it's actually moving a lot of that finding work to the first-line user, right? What I mean by first-line user is the reviewers. For example, your non-forensically trained individual will be able to, you know, if this is implemented in a portable case or, you know, type of system, if they allow regular users to ask questions to the AI, it will help, I believe, folks be able to get to stuff faster using natural language. They don't need to know a lot about technical stuff to say, I want to know about Bitcoin. Where is it? Well, it's in all these places. They don't need to know what those places are because the AI will find it for them. So that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. Yeah. Of course, we need to discuss this a little bit more. So the last one is the one that I found really interesting. Do you recall this? You can ask the AI stupid questions, right? A stupid question that he gave it was, any crime or illegal activity? And I understand what he meant by that, right? Like, is that a stupid question? What do you think here? Is that a stupid question?
It's pretty vague.
Yeah. Well, and it is vague. And I like that he described it as stupid. But yeah. I found it funny because guess what?
That's people the question. Ask it.
Yeah, everybody, where is the evidence of the crime? Uh-huh. That's the question
find
everybody's
going to
ask. Everybody,
yeah, you're right.
There's not a button for find the evidence. They're just going to tell it to find the evidence.
Right.
And actually, the tool did a fairly decent job. It said, you know, there's no evidence of any crime or legal activity discussed in the text data. And the reasons it gave, it even gave an argument saying, well, it's going to, could be, but we require more. It says, it is impossible to conclude that this request is related to any wrongdoing and give you the stuff. And that's the part where now the AI is starting to bug me.
Yeah.
What do you think, Heather? What do you think about that?
I don't know about like that. I don't know about that. I mean, I would love to know the rate of false positives on that. But yeah, questions are going to be crazy.
No, and I think you hit the nail on the head. With the rate of false positives or hallucinations. And I'm not saying his tool does that. I'm not saying that. Obviously, I'm just seeing the demo and that's it. But the AIs are known for that. Now,
right. Good thing definitely.
I think if you saw that, is that whenever the AI responds, underneath there's some reference to what it's talking about, so you can confirm it. But the question is, well, like you said, what will the error rate be? And we can determine that if we have a large data set, which means people using this live. And I say live, but usually in the daily work.
Yes.
And it's tough because the testing is happening not in a testing environment. It's happening live because you can test in a testing environment, but that's not enough data or use cases to make a determination about the tools. Does that even make sense, Heather, to you?
Right. It's a lot different using test data that's set up for that specific function, right? You know what you're looking for, so you set up the test, and it contains that. And it's a small data set usually when you set up the test data. I would say, like an example, on like evidence items, an example is there's an AI function in one of the tools that looks for grooming. And I mean, I was looking through, I ran a couple of times, I'm looking through data, and grooming is mom telling son, I love you, honey, see you later. So, I mean, the false positives are like, do I really want to sift through all the false positives when it's such a big data set? Because there are a lot when it comes to the AI features.
Oh, I love that example. That's a good example. And at some point, the returns are going to overpower the work's going to overpower the returns.
Yeah.
Because at that point, I'd rather just read the messages straight up.
Right. Oh, definitely.
Go one by one. It'll be quicker, right?
Right. Sometimes with the AI features with the images too, right? You're looking at, for example, what you just said with the Balkasoff. You're looking for the faces with guns. You may have a few faces with guns up front, but if you have a really large data set, there's a ton of images in there. Now, I'm not saying with Balkasoff, I've never tested it, but with other AI that I have tested, a ton of other images in there that are not even close to being a gun or a face. So,
yeah, and that level of uncertainty of percentage of false positive or hallucinations, we cannot determine that on ourselves using one or two cases, you know. A lot of cases are needed because this thing is kind of is deterministic and it's also probabilistic at the same time. How these AIs work, how those internal decision trees happen based on training, and that we cannot really quantify, you know, ourselves. They're so large, right? It doesn't fit in my mind how this thing works. So that's I guess. And let me know if you agree with this or not. I think this is a good tool that could be used just to start.
Yes.
Just to kind of frame your investigation. But, I mean, I'm afraid that people will take that output, screenshot it, and say, look, here's the crime. And,
yeah.
You know, I don't know.
That's my fear with the automation. Like, you use the automation features, check all that shows up in the automation, and call it a day. So.
Yeah, I know. Like, like Kevin's saying, maybe the AI says, look, there's too much crime here. I quit. The AI is taking a vacation today. This device is too guilty.
That's good.
Yeah. No, and I think that speaks also on one last point. Mm-hmm. In regards to the training data. Could I foresee an AI that's really trained in the federal code of, you know, in the federal code of law or your state law system, yeah, and rules of evidence, all that type of stuff, and go through a device and make even some prosecutorial determinations? I foresee a company maybe doing that, right? And again, that knife, you know, it's good to kind of frame your mindset,
yeah,
but you cannot outsource that to the AI, no matter how big that training data set is.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's going to continue to get more sophisticated, and we'll see some of that type of stuff where it gets better at some things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think again, I said last point, I have one last point. This is the real last point. It also speaks to us being able to communicate with a freaking machine now, right?
Yeah.
It's not only talking to people, it's talking to the computer, because whatever you ask the computer, response will be as good as the question you're asking it. And how, mm-hmm, and if folks have used ChatGPT, not this AI in forensics, but plain ChatGPT, if you're trying to code or do something, you ask it a question, it give you a response, and you have to do another question to kind of narrow that response and kind of lead the AI to help it go to where you really want to know. So,
right.
So it'll be interesting how we have to develop certain community build phrases or ways of asking things to these AIs to be effective.
Definitely. All right. Enough with the AI.
Yep.
So
actually not that much, because by next week somebody will come with some other AI thing, and we will have to talk about it.
Point on it.
Oh no. I already gave you two last points.
Okay. All right. So I wanted to talk also about another tool that we showed in a previous episode called UFade, which has the capability of pulling some of those iOS logs as well. I'm going to throw some slides up because I have some screenshots that I stole from the creator of UFade, Christian Peter, and he has a few new updates. So the tool is now able to perform full file system extractions on already jailbroken devices. You can see on the screen is the interface for UFade, and option 4 gives you that file system backup for jailbroken devices. And then there's another screenshot he had on his LinkedIn where it's actually performing the file system backup.
Yeah, and this is, you know, again, like Heather said, full file system. If it's jailbroken, yeah, you have that access, you can pull everything down, which is pretty neat.
Yeah, and free tool. So you don't have to spend thousands and thousands of dollars to get a full file system. So,
and it's kind of interesting because there are companies out there, well-known companies, whose capability is this. And
that's
and
true.
I'm not going to call them out, but everybody in this field knows who they or who these are. And I'm like, really? That's the offering? Okay.
But yeah, so you can do it free here with UFade. Another update to UFade is that it's able to capture live network traffic from your iOS device as a PCAP file. So again, the interface is up on the screen, and option 3 is sniff device traffic. And then I'm just going to show a quick screenshot that I took from Christian's LinkedIn that he posted of it in action.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. If I mean, possible for malware analysis, maybe, or mm-hmm, if you're trying to intercept some malicious traffic, there's a lot of utility to be able to do that on a mobile device.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, another update that was announced recently is unlocking the developer mode options on devices with iOS 17 and up. I didn't initially know what this one was doing. So I actually messaged Christian tonight and asked him. So it takes screenshots from the device screen with that developer options enabled. And to further clarify, he told me you can take single screenshots or loop chats. And then it's highlighting every message and then it starts scrolling. And when it reaches the end, you'll have a screenshot per message in the chats on the device. I had asked him, is this like similar to what Cellebrite's chat capture is? And it sounds similar to what that chat capture is.
Yeah, no, that's an awesome capability. And again, yeah, at the cost of nothing is unbelievable.
Yeah, very, very cool new features in the tool that we previously outlined how to use it to pull the logs too. So you can see that on previous episodes.
Yep. Yeah. And again, Christian, thank you for that work that you're putting out. I used it a couple of times and the software works really solid. I do appreciate it.
Yeah. So Android had an update this week too. So they have theft protection features that are meant to keep your data safe. So they're announcing a bunch of new theft protection features.
Yeah, and we're going to mention them in a second, but I understand where they're coming from. And sometimes we think, well, some folks, well, they're against us being able to do lawful access. Let me tell you, I've gone a lot of travel overseas, and in some countries, the secondhand market for stolen devices is huge. It's a big black market, millions, maybe billions of dollars worth, where you're walking down the street and somebody snatches your phone. They go off with it. They, they clear it out, mm-hmm. and there we sell it. Some companies in some of these countries, what they do is they take the IMEI, and if someone's stolen, they blacklist that IMEI. So for folks that don't know what it is, an IMEI is the individual identifier for the device. Okay, if they see that stolen IMEI hitting their networks, they cut off that phone. Well, these criminals are really, how can I say this, creative. And what they do is, well, easy. Let's just ship this phone to the next country over and sell it over there. It might not work here, but it might work two countries over. And they go sell it somewhere else, right? So some of these features are, for example, if somebody snatches the phone from your hand, I guess it's some sort of type of machine learning or some way, some sensor activity that combined together tells the device, hey, you're being snatched. Mm-hmm. And immediately what the phone does is it blocks itself, locks itself up, and then you're able to then remotely find it or even wipe it and delete it. And that's actually, I'm going to jump straight to the deletion part because I just mentioned it. I haven't seen many phones being deleted after seizure. Lawful seizure because folks don't know how to do it, right? They have to go to a website. They have to log in. They might need dual factor authentication. If the dual factor authentication is the phone itself and they don't have the phone, they can't do anything. Well, one of the features that Google is putting up is you can go and take any phone from your buddy next to you, take it. As long as you know your own phone number and you know a specific passcode that you set up, you can access those capabilities immediately. And to me, that means that folks we all should start getting, me included, a Faraday box and those little Faraday bags. And we have them, but do we really, really use them, or we use them and then we open them, when we get to the lab, or then you lost the whole plot.
You have to get a Faraday room. We have a Faraday room.
Oh, but you're fancy. You all in New fancy. York are fancy. Yeah. I don't got a room at all. I barely have a room for myself. But no, I mean, a Faraday room, obviously, like you all do up there, is the best scenario. Yeah. But at least a little Faraday bag. And I guess our standard procedure moving forward has to be that not to only high-risk phones, but to all phones.
I think. Yes. I agree. Absolutely. So we will get them. Sometimes they're in a Faraday bag, but when we get them in the Faraday bag, we don't even open the bag until we go into the room. And if you had the box, you could open the bag in the box. But definitely, they all should be equipped and in with a Faraday bag upon seizure.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we say it in our courses, but people haven't seen that push for it. I think we're getting to the point where it's gonna become, a thing that you have to do. With all these advancements. Some of the other thing it does is if let's say if the thief right tries to disconnect your phone from the network for a long time. So let's say I'm like, I have the phone, easy. I'll just stick it on airplane mode. Done, right? And I take it, right? And it's unlocked. If some time passes, it's going to lock itself up, no matter what the settings are. And you're like, well, you know what? I'm going to change the settings. Well, now settings, you could change them only by having the passcode. Well, now, if you it's enabled, you can put the PIN code, the phone unlocks, you want to change those settings. Guess what? It's going to ask for biometrics.
Right?
And now that you have to have both, whereas before, having the PIN code overrode any biometrics because the PIN code was the thing. Now it will ask for both, right? And again, I see that as a good thing for consumers in regards to being able to protect and stolen devices and dissuade these criminals from stealing them, because why would they go to the effort of stealing a phone? They cannot wipe because it will not allow it to be factory reset by a thief. That's another capability.
Right.
These people stole the phones, they factory reset them for selling them, and they will not be able to set them up again because the device will ask you for the credentials for the Google account. So, and so you know, there's benefits to that, but also some drawbacks for us, obvious drawbacks.
Yeah, definitely. There's another feature that has also a private space that hides your sensitive apps. So like your banking apps or anything that's like personal to you or could potentially hold private data that would allow thieves to get into your accounts. That private space feature lets you create a separate area in your phone that you can hide and lock with a separate PIN code.
And usually there's apps that do that, and usually some suspects do it. And those apps, you know, we have ways of circumventing it. We can go and reverse engineer some of that code, do some things, brute force them. But now this capability is built in the operating system. And how is that going to look for us? I don't know yet. And, and this update, you'll be like, well, this is going to happen with the latest phones. No, any phone from Android 10 upwards, which is pretty much any phone, will benefit from the these updates. And they're saying the time frame is by the end of the year. So we need to start thinking about how are we going to address some of these issues and train our first responders or the people doing the seizures on these capabilities, because they will need to be even more aware on how to properly seize these devices and being able to do the work that we need to do on a timely basis.
Yeah. This is the perfect topic, too, for somebody who's looking for a research project. Get some test data, test it out, extract it, and see how this is stored and how it's going to affect us in the forensic community.
Yeah, and I'm going to jump ahead a tiny bit, but I think one way they're going to be doing this is by leveraging that multi-user function of the device, where you have more than one account in a phone, which that's a thing that all phones, modern phones do. I can log into your phone and use it, and then I can log off, and you can log in, and you use it like a computer.
Right.
And I think that's how they're going to do some of that, I think, because they've been giving hints in the some of the releases, the alphas from the latest Android is going to be coming out. Some of that code, you could see it there, that they're looking or doing that. But that's all. That's all I'm going to say now, because the next section, you're going to talk about it a little bit more.
Well, the next section is a little bit different than that. So Samsung Dual App is something I didn't really know anything about. We have a new computer, newer. She's been there in the office for a little while, but a newer computer forensic analyst named Deanna in our office. And she does extractions for like her main job duty in our office. And she came across user account 95 in a Samsung phone. So what is it? We didn't know. And she took it upon herself to take one of my test phones and go do some research and try and figure out how that user 95 account is created. So you could see that it was related to something called Dual Messenger. So she started out by researching what Dual Messenger even is for Samsung phones. And she found that it's a setting that can be enabled on specific Samsung models that'll allow you to use two separate accounts for the same application. So a little bit different. It's for an app, not for the device. I'm going to just pull up some pictures that she has from my test device.
But think about it. It might be the same thing because you can say, well, it's for the app.
Yeah.
But yep. if the app is sitting in a separate user space, like another user. To you, it's like, oh, it's another app. It's a different app. No, it's a whole different user.
Yes.
And a private space like Samsung does on their secure folder. What they call it? Secure mm-hmm. folder, right?
Secure folder, yep.
Yeah, secure folder, we know already, it's another user. That's right. all they do, that they encrypt that other user. So again, we don't know. We haven't looked at it, but I have an inkling that that's what's happening here as well. But we'll see.
So I have a screenshot for you to show some of that. So so she went to the settings, found the dual messenger settings. And under the dual messenger, you'll find any of the available apps. So the apps that are capable of having a dual account installed. She enabled Snapchat and installed the second copy of Snapchat. When she installed that, the little icon, you can see it in the picture if you're listening, so I'll explain it. There's a little Snapchat icon, and at the bottom right corner, it's an orange circle with two white circles inside of it. Once she installed it in the settings, out on the home screen of the device, you have the user's original Snapchat icon, and then that Snapchat icon that has the orange circle with the two little white circles inside. So when she extracted the data, the user accounts, she had 0, so that your main user account, she had 95, which houses the dual app capable applications, the 150, which is the secure folder, and then 1000, actually Josh Hickman told me what 1000 was the other day. I didn't know that either. It's the secure browser for Samsung.
Josh is in the chat. So Josh, tell us again, write it in the chat. What's
thank
about
you, Josh. 1000?
Yeah, tell us, please.
The secure browser.
he told us already?
Yeah, he told me the other day. So it's the secure browser.
Okay,
yeah.
So you remembered. Okay.
Yeah. So under the users, you have the separate user accounts, and 95 holds that Snapchat dual application. So I asked Deanna in my office, I said, well, what if you enable another application and you have two? Does it create like 96 or do they both go into 95? Well, she tested that as well, and they're both in the 95 user account.
Explain that to me again. So the user, user zero, I guess that would be her account, has these apps in the system, and it just keeps dumping them in that 95, quote unquote, other user, right?
Yes.
As opposed to making a new user for each app.
Correct. We installed two. She installed two, and they both were under user account 95.
That's interesting. That's pretty interesting.
I thought it was going to hop to maybe 96, but it didn't. And she's doing all this testing. She's going to write a nice blog on it. She's got it started. It's coming along nice, but she's got a little more testing she wants to do with it. So
yeah, and actually, Kevin's making a great point. Maybe for her testing, he says multiple user data could be mixed. So it'd be interesting to have another user account, not zero, but another main user account.
And then
see, we will dump it on the quote unquote 95, or would it make its own 90 something else, and then put. So now, Kevin, you're like making my brain move around. how can we determine those relationships, right? How can we determine that zero is linked to that 95? And again, it's hard for folks that you're not looking if you're listening, but what Heather put on the screen is those user account directories. And what we're discussing is how can we discover those relationships by looking straight at a file system. That's now I'm excited.
Deanna, if you're listening, or you may be watching the recording tomorrow, but if you're listening, you have more work to do. I think she's having fun with it, so that's good.
Yeah, and I'm going to share some comments here because we got a lot of luminaries in the chat.
I see that.
So Josh is saying their profile, so somewhat similar to Windows accounts. I mean, it is based on some – so Josh has been looking at some of the code that's coming out. As you know, Android is open source. So he's commenting that they're considered profiles, somewhat similar to Windows accounts. We have system, local, user, and guest. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
So 95, he has a dual app, you know, and then he makes another list, a few more. So 1000 is the S browser, 1001 is the private browsing in the S browser. The S browser is a Samsung browser. And I want to make a point with that. Samsung is really known for saying, okay, Android from Google is going to come with this functionality. And for them to be able to use or, you know, update their software to that version, they have to have the same capabilities to say they're Android 15, right? They can't say they're Android 15 and then not have that capability. Right. Android forces you to have those capabilities, but Android doesn't force you on how you implement it. So Samsung implements things differently. Samsung puts the digital well-being data in a database in a whole different place, right? For example, right? And this might be, and again, give me your thoughts, Heather. This might be kind of like an inkling. This is how Samsung is going to implement that capability. But it very well could be that Android is going to have the same thing. It's just maybe in a different place or in a different way, but the same type of concept.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we're probably going to see this more in all of the devices.
Were you able to use a tool from that we have now and parse it and get, I mean, what type of results you all get?
Yeah, so it's supported. The major extraction tools actually alert you that there is a dual app account. And if it'll ask you if you want to brute force it. The tools will also pull the data, and the major tools are also parsing it as well.
All right, but I really wonder if you have more than one user account. Although that's kind of like an edge case, most people don't share their phones.
Right.
But we need to look at everything, right? So I was wondering if you have more than one user with dual apps enabled on each user, how would you know who generated that data? You know what I mean?
Well, Deanna's gonna be testing that when I tell her tomorrow, unless she's listening, and you can get started now, Deanna.
Wow, you drive a hard bargain here.
Well, she's having fun with it. I'm not making her do it. So
I know. You're kind and nice. We all know that.
Oh, she's awesome. So
yeah. Again, I gotta show. You know what? We gotta bring Josh one day just to chat here with us and be on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, so multi-user on iOS, so that makes absolute sense to me that that will be definitely coming. He's also telling us that you have to have that corroboration with other artifacts to help tie the profiles, and that makes sense to me.
Okay, yeah, it does.
If there's no one direct thing that you could tell, at least for now, you will have to do that. But my inkling, and hopefully the research that you're all doing starts leading us in that direction, there has to be some sort of internal indication of what is connected to what, you know?
Right.
But even at the end of the day, that corroboration with other artifacts is still necessary for that validation and to actually paint a picture when you're trying to present it. So that makes absolute sense.
Well, we're going to find that corroboration because I won't give up till I do. And Deanna is exactly the same way. So,
well, she has somebody to guide her through that process that knows a lot with you. Check this out. So the folks at Exordia and Jessica Hyde, they are my pronunciation is so Hispanic.
It sounded fine.
It's hard for me to pronounce a word that only has one vowel at the end.
You did good.
In English. So, but they are, I mean, again, really important organization in regards to establishing different testing and validation procedures in our field. Mm-hmm. And they're watching in the lobby. So hi, everybody.
Hi.
We love the work that you do. I in LinkedIn, I follow all the happenings when you all get together and come out with your different products and documents. So we appreciate you, and we appreciate you watching. So
yeah, definitely. All right, let me remove this. So we will continue working on the dual app stuff and have a paper eventually. So
yeah, we'll announce it on our social media and keep an eye out for that. I'm really excited about it now that you discussed it. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. So another quick update here. We have some collaboration with John Hyla. If you don't know who John Hyla is, he actually went and taught with us at IASIS the last 2 weeks prior. He has an electronics canine named Hannah, who we love. I showed a picture last week. But he has been collaborating with CCL Solutions on updates to their SegB script. So he actually is improving the usability of the library for parsing iOS and macOS SegB files. He was able to shorten the amount of code needed for the iLeap, specifically for the iLeap artifacts. And it now internally handles checking if it's a SegB or a SegOne or a SegB1 or a SegB2, sorry, and processes automatically and returns you the data.
Yeah, and John is the granddaddy or the father of our SegB knowledge in the field. He was the first mm-hmm. one that actually said, you know what, this, what is this? Mm-hmm. Is this important? So he's the first one that put something out in public, and I mean, the whole field benefit from it. It's kind of funny because at the beginning, that article came out and nobody really thought much of it until they figured out, holy crap.
Yeah.
this is super important. So I was honored. We were honored to teach with him over at IASIS. And, you know, we're going to have him back next year. Hopefully his agency continues to send it with us.
Yeah.
Anyways, I digress. The point I'm making is that he made some good. One of the things that he changed that I'm really happy that he did is that the code as it was, and it was correct, right?
Mm-hmm.
The SegB file tells you, hey, these are the amount of bytes you need to read to get to the protobuf payload, because the data within the SegB file is in a protobuf formatted payload, most of it. And it said, read from this byte to this byte. And when you did that, the first 8 bytes were not actually part of the protobuf. So I had to, in my code, and we learned about that yesterday, right, Heather? We had to, in the code, clean those first 8 bytes out.
Yeah.
To then actually get to the protobuf. But that's been taken care of. So now you don't have to worry about those 8 bytes in your code. The library will account for them automatically, which is, makes my life so much easier and Heather's life so much easier, which I know she will appreciate.
Yeah, I'm not good at figuring out how to remove the bytes.
No, she's good. She's just going through that learning process, and everybody's bad until you learn how to do it. So don't be hard on yourself, girl.
Yeah, the computer was about to go out the window last night, so I had some choice words for it.
Fantastic. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. I
that
love
was
your
it.
Computer.
Oh, that was definitely it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, so check that out. And again, I motivate folks. Look, the field is moving to, it's moving fast, and you need to keep up. And I one way is start learning some scripting. I've been having, again, tangent. Sorry, little tiny soapbox moment.
God.
I got folks in the last 2 weeks ask me, hey, I got this JSON inside a database or these type of data stores. What do I do? What tool do I use? And the thing is that the tool will format it for you to look at, maybe indent it for you so it looks nicer. But that data source might have so much gunk in it that you don't care about. Right? That what you need to do, as part of what we do in our IASIS class, is give you some tools. Say, look, you need to learn a little bit of scripting so you're able to pull the relevant items of that thing to actually come to proper conclusions. And sitting down and waiting for the tools to do that, it might not come anytime soon for your intents and purposes, right? So we need to start thinking of coding not as a good thing to have if you're an examiner, but as a necessary thing to have if you're coming into the field. That's my perspective.
Yeah, no, I agree. Oh, well, and you can see it, you can view it in a lot of the major tools, but how are you reporting it? Like, there's no add this to my report function in a lot of those data viewers.
Look, Heather, don't feel bad.
I see it.
Somebody of the stature as the forensic scooter is also learning with you. So if he's telling you that he's learning and he's putting hard work, you're in excellent company. So
listen, most of the time, Scott, you are teaching me because I am constantly referencing your blogs. So
you and me both.
Uh-huh. Rereading and rereading. What does he mean here? Wait, what?
Yeah, and not because it's not clear, it's because it's so much good stuff that we're like, I cannot hold it all in my brain at the same time.
It's all good. There's just so much.
Actually, we're going to talk about you more I think, is it right now? When? No, in a little bit. We're going to talk about in a little bit.
Shortly here. So more research. I'm on a kick of pointing out people's good research. So today, actually, on LinkedIn, there was a post from Brian Hempstead, and he did some work with the Session application. If you don't know what the Session application is, it's a privacy-based chat app. So Cellebrite, I was the tool he used. He was able to decrypt and parse the data, but he takes it a step further and he validates the data, right? He goes in, he looks at the database, and he's validating what he's seeing in the parse data. And the research blog, I'm going to put his, this will be in the show notes, but I'll put it up anyway. The research blog actually outlines how he's able to identify which chat thread a particular attached image originated from, which is really important when you have these chat applications. Sometimes the images are, most of the time, the images are stored separately, and being able to relate them back to exactly which chat the images go with can be really difficult. So definitely a good research paper to read.
Absolutely. And again, even if, and I we say this a lot, even if the tool does it for you, coming out with a research paper, you know, testing and validating that mm-hmm. your data and testing the tool, it's so important. I mean, yes. it's another way of doing kind of like a peer review type of work that you can then say, look, this is not me making this up, or it's just a tool hallucinating things. There's right. backing to this. So we appreciate right. folks like Brian that make the time to kind of guide us through their analysis, and we all learn from it.
Yeah, definitely. Another announcement. I'll let you take this one.
Yeah, talking about learning. If you all don't know Phil Hagen, you should. Phil Hagen has been yeah. around for a long time. He's really well known for doing forensics in networks. Mm-hmm. And I've been one of his students, one of the classes. I really enjoyed that class. I actually want to take it again. Obviously, there have been advancements. And not only does he teach the SANS network forensics class, he spearheads a Linux distribution used for network forensics that you can download and benefit from. And he's come out with a YouTube channel, and I'm really excited. I want to, after my trips, these trips that are coming up, when I'm done with that, I'm going to start going through his videos where he goes about all the network forensics knowledge that he's teaching. He has them as a series of videos. So I really recommend folks to go and subscribe to his YouTube channel. It's really easy. You have the link there.
I do. Yeah.
It's youtube.com/@Phil with one L, Hagen, Hagen. And again, he's a fantastic instructor, a mastering instructor. Knows his stuff back and forward, and you will learn a lot from him. So I'm really happy that he's putting that content out to the community.
Yeah, in his post about his YouTube channel too, he specifically says that anyone starting out in network investigations and analysis, this playlist will be very helpful for you. So if you're looking to just get into network analysis or investigations, this may be a good place to start.
And let me tell you, for folks that are digital forensics in law enforcement and you do phones and computers all day long, when you go out to the private sector, if you start getting ready for this type of work, you'll benefit by expanding your skills.
Definitely.
Because you see, well, network forensics for what? When there's intrusions in an enterprise, the nuggets of the intrusion, when it's happened and how, guess where they're going to be? Mm-hmm. In your network logs, in the devices in between, like the routers, or in the devices that are gateways to your network that keep logs and keep information about that. Has there been any exfiltration from that network? Because we want to know if it has and be able to remediate and you know, take into account those. How do you do that? Well, I don't know. It's not on the computer. Well, it will not be on the computer. It will be based on network forensics. If you have a network where you're doing packet captures, if it's a sensitive network, how do I go about dealing with PCAP files? Maybe it's not that sensitive, but you're getting NetFlow data. And again, if you're like a cop like ourselves and you never heard about the term about NetFlow or the term PCAP, well, maybe you should.
Right.
So a good way is going to the channel, start learning about those things. It can only make you better.
Yeah, I would say that this is one of my weaker areas, and I'm looking forward to going and starting from the beginning of the playlist and watching all the way through.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So another update from this week, VMware Fusion Pro. If you use VMware, it's now available free for personal use, the pro version. So you could use VMware Player before as a free version, but now the Pro and Workstation Pro have different license models, one free for personal use and then one paid for commercial use.
And when I heard that, I felt the heavens open, the angel singing, hallelujah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I have any reaction for that? Let me see.
You don't have any fireworks or anything?
Oh, yeah. Look. Yes.
There you go.
I have fireworks. Folks that cannot are listening, I have fireworks behind me. I'm going to put some a little bit of confetti coming down. I'm really happy because, you know, VMware was bought by a company. I forgot what the company was. And they've been making some moves there in regards to their pricing. And I think this is a really welcome way of getting into the good graces of the user base. And I agree with it.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, if you're a corporate user, you might have some comments about the non-free model, but I don't care. I don't care about you. Sorry.
That's nice.
good luck with that.
They also, in the article that I've outlined, I'll have in the show notes, they also have a link to a podcast that's available that discusses all of the changes. So if anybody's interested in that as well, they have a whole podcast explaining the changes, and part of it is called Did I Hear Free? So if you heard free and you want to hear more about it, tune into their podcast.
Exactly. It's not like fat free where you don't have fat. It's like free as in you can use it.
Yes.
Yeah, here we go. Cesar told us it's Broadcom bought VMware.
Oh, okay. That's perfect. Thanks, I was looking at that today. I couldn't remember it.
It was the tip of my tongue. I was about to stick it out to see if I could read it. thanks for reminding me of that. Yeah.
All right. So what's new with the Leap?
All right. So I said a second ago that we're going to talk more about Scott and, you know, the forensic scooter. So he's really well known as he's the granddaddy of Photos.SQLite analysis. Mm-hmm. And for folks that are not in the know, in iOS, Photos.SQLite keeps track of the images from that device, and it has a ton of information. One of the things I like about that database is that it's a data point to determine where a picture came from. So he added support for one of the queries that he has within the queries that he shares, and also within my own tooling, iLeap and the Leaps, to be able to get embedded plists out of that, and also get embedded preview images, which is pretty good because if it's sitting there, I can look at that image in case, you know, so the garbage collection hasn't gone around yet, right? So you have another way of getting at the data. And we say this in other episodes. Data is like bunny. It likes to replicate. So you got to know where the stuff is, right?
Right.
The only drawback is that it's a pretty involved, intense script. And it will take some time to run. So the decision that we made, and by we, I mean Johan, which again, Johan, we love you. He said, maybe we should make this optional. What that means is that when you run iLeap, it's not going to be checked by default. So that gives you the power to say, look, do I really want to spend 5-6 extra minutes on looking for something? Then you can do that. And you might tell me, 5 minutes is not a long time. The Leaps are designed to be quick. And to me, 5 minutes is a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot for the Leaps, definitely.
Yeah. For other tools, 5 minutes is just them starting to process.
See if we can even find the database.
Exactly. Is the computer on? It's just eating up your memory. Those 5 minutes used to eat your memory up. So that's a long time in our benchmarking for that. But it's not Scott's fault. It's just that there's so much data there to be to get, then that's how it is, right? So it's optional. So what I tell folks is, look, for these, run it without the optional stuff on first to get your quick hits. And then if you need to go deep dive, then only check the Photos.SQLite or check some of the other ones that take a long time. And then do that with more time. You can do those while you're looking at your first parsing for quick wins.
Yeah.
So another update, it's K9 mail support by Kalinko. So we appreciate you. Kevin has made the report in the Leaps a little bit more pretty. So it's actually highlighting some of the header sections on the left side of the interface. So I appreciate that. He showed me, I'm like, dude, of course it looks great. Do it. Do it. So he sent, he made those changes. And we are working, and by we I mean mostly Heather, on a new artifact.
Right.
So what are we working on? And
We're updating the current one, actually, because there already was one. But the browser state database. So previously on a prior episode, we talked about Ian Wiffen's research on the browser state database and how the last visited timestamp doesn't necessarily mean last visited. So was just going to go in and change that field so it didn't say last visited timestamp anymore. But there's another table in that database that includes tab sessions data. So I thought we'll just add that tab session data in to match up with the tabs that are open. And it didn't end up being as easy as I thought it was going to be. I am struggling. I'm getting help from a pro.
You're being too hard on yourself.
God.
You're doing good. You're doing good.
So it'll be coming, but it's not available quite yet.
Well, the thing is that, I'm gonna point you, but I'm not gonna do it for you, as you know. So,
I appreciate that.
I'm just gonna push you along.
I thought I would do it without asking Alex for help. I'm like, let me just try it myself. I don't help me. Yeah, right.
No, look, I mean, as I was telling you yesterday, I mean, I really appreciate something like Yogeshka 3, which, again, really up my understanding. And I had to leave some of that ego to the side and say, you know what? I need help. I need to actually learn the process. So we're going through it, and it's, you know, you're doing great. So don't
I finally caved and asked for the help.
That's actually the harder thing. It's not the coding. It's actually getting to that point. So well done.
Yeah. I get to a spot though. I'll get to a spot where I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then Alex is like, let's start from the beginning. And I'm like, no, I know. So that was why the computer almost went out the window last night.
Well, and for folks that are like, what are you talking about? So
yeah.
you can understand, say, well, I know this is the output I want, but mm-hmm. do you really know how you got there?
And I didn't.
Yeah. And actually getting there is more important than the output. That's kind of the lesson yeah. we were talking about yesterday. Just because you got the right answer right. doesn't mean that it's right.
Right. And I'm not going to be able to replicate it unless I understand it. So
yeah. Or troubleshoot it when it goes wrong because, right. because you don't right. know what happened. You just know right. that it's there. Right.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
And I mean, it's again, we have a lot of fun doing that. So, mm-hmm. and folks, again, we motivate you to look into ways of expanding your knowledge, expanding yourselves and being better.
Yeah.
I want to say something real quick about that database, the Browser State database. I didn't see it a lot. Now I see it everywhere in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
It's like when you buy a car, it's like, oh, look, I bought a new, a BMW, whatever. And you have it. And now when you drive, you see it everywhere.
Yeah.
that's me now. I see that browser, that DB everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's important because a lot of I've seen cases coming to wrong conclusions. And we discussed this a few episodes ago. Check out Ian Whiffen's blog on the browserstate.dv.
Yeah, definitely.
In regards to how those timestamps are populated, people are coming to wrong conclusions, both on the prosecution side and the defense mm-hmm. side, on
yes,
what
they
those
are.
Timestamps mean. And that's a big problem. How can I say this? Some tooling might decide not to even show it because it's complex and mm-hmm. there's no certain way of determining where the timestamp comes from, under what circumstances. And that's a decision that tooling makers can make. And others can decide to still show it and hopefully put a lot of flags around it saying, you know, timestamp of, you know, indeterminate origin. Or I don't know how to describe that field.
Yeah, I'm still debating what to call it.
It's tough because we're talking about it. I know we're up off the hour, folks. Just 3 more minutes and we're done. like, do we want to show that to users if we cannot determine certain things with certainty? Or do we want to hide it to avoid confusion? Or do we want to show it just for completion? And, I mean, you have an opinion on that, Heather.
Yeah, I mean, I want to see it when I'm working on the case. I want to see it. I have, like, a general understanding of what different circumstances can make that change, the timestamp. So I still want to see it. I still know it's associated with those tabs. I just never would go in and testify that this is the date and time that that specific website that's tied to that tab was visited, because it's been found in research, in Ian's research, that that's not true. So, mm-hmm. but I still want to see it.
Yeah. And I'm like you, I also want to see it. Again, it talks about, we talked about at the beginning, mm-hmm. if you have multiple data points, maybe you cannot point to that one, but you can build this pattern across yeah. multiple data points to come to a conclusion. So
right.
we need that. But at the same time, a lot of examiners don't have the expertise to look at it that way. And is it a fault of the tooling, or is it our fault, or is it a way to, we can bridge that gap? We're going to try with our artifact yeah. and see how that comes out.
Yeah. You just have to be very careful in how you name that timestamp field. So
yeah, absolutely. That header for that could make or break a case. So
yeah.
again, folks, if you're not in the loop, again, do Google Ian Whiffen, Whiffin, Double Black is his blog, blog. And look for the browserstate.db entry. It's a
yes.
really in-depth research on this database. And I highly recommend you do that.
Yeah, I do as well. So we've made it to the end. We're at the meme of the week, the most important part. Let me see if I can share it here.
No, it's truly the most important part. So let's give some fireworks. Let's get some balloons going there. All right, describe it for us. What are we seeing here, Heather?
Okay, so we have finished a conference, speaking, teaching event, and now you're back, right? Back in your office, pending work stuff, and then we have a nice little expletive to outline that pending work stuff that you came back to. I picked this one this week because we were just gone for 2 weeks, and I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I got back to a trial that had already started and had to go testify. So the little expletive may have been my first response or something similar to it. But also all the work that piles up, right? All of the things that still need to get done, even though you were gone for 2 weeks.
See, I watch, I know you haven't watched it, but I watched Fallout on Amazon not too long ago. Mm-hmm. So all my cursing is okie dokie.
Ah, okay. You may have to replace that on this meme then, but it will not be as impactful.
Oh, no. The meme stays as is, right?
Okay, good.
I know Kevin watched the show, so he knows. And I like the meme a lot because, well, it's from The Office. What's this guy's name in The Office? I forgot his name.
I've never seen The Office.
Oh my god! Okay, get out.
I know.
Of here.
I get picked on at work constantly.
You got 10 seconds to leave the stream. Okay.
I know.
Even I seen it, right? So anyways, so he's really happy there standing, like having a good time. I just finished my conference. And then the pending work stuff kind of creeps up on him.
Yeah.
And then kind of shows up on the, he's like, oh!
Yep.
you know what, right? So I like that. That's how I felt also when I got, Dwight, there we go.
Caesar saving the day.
Yeah, Dwight Schrute. Schrute is that? I see my pronunciation is so bad. But yeah, so I think it's a really funny meme because that's how I felt after taking for IASIS and how well I feel again when I come from Argentina.
I was going to say we may have to reuse it in a couple of weeks, but you'll have to make a new one that has the similar theme for the next podcast.
That's true. I gotta think of something that's topical for the region. We'll see.
All right.
I think we're at the other podcast. Thank you for staying with us. Yeah. Thanks for the folks that watch live, and also thank you for the folks that are watching and listening later. We appreciate you. Please send us your comments, your ideas, constructive criticism. We love that. And again, we're going to be out for a couple of weeks due to travel. Mm-hmm. So please go to our LinkedIn, Digital Forensics Now podcast, to get notice on where we're coming with a new episode as well.
Yes.
And I think that's it. I mean, anything else for the good of the order, Heather?
That's it. I see a question about the leaps in the chat, from Mr. Maka, and I'm gonna get with you offline and answer your questions.
Well, you're awesome. And that's Heather. We appreciate it. All right, folks. Then we'll see each other soonish. Just keep our eye out. Peace. See ya.
Bye. Thank you.